Welcome back to Brains and Guts, the GI Innovation Podcast from the American College of Gastroenterology. I am Dr. Vladimir Kushner, the chair of the ACG Innovation and Technology Committee. Today, we're excited to welcome Dr. Brennan Spiegel to the podcast. Dr. Spiegel is a gastroenterologist, clinical researcher, and expert in all things AI and virtual reality and endoscopy in gastroenterology. He currently serves as the Director of Health Service Research and Chair of Digital Health Ethics at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. In this conversation, Dr. Spiegel explains his vision for ethically sound and patient-centered artificial intelligence in medicine. As he describes, the future of artificial intelligence in gastroenterology could bring us unparalleled cancer prevention and personalized treatment. But to achieve this vision, we need to tackle the ethical considerations now. We covered so many aspects of how physician-patient relationship might evolve in an ethical way, including clinical judgment, accountability, and malpractice, and informed consent. We also tackled other thorny issues, like testing and monitoring for bias in artificial intelligence tools, data ownership, appropriate use of predictive algorithms, and more. We hope you enjoy.
Dr. Spiegel, thanks really again for joining us and sharing your expertise. My first question to you, and I know you've written extensively about digital health and the patient experience, how do you see AI changing the physician-patient relationship in GI care, and where do we risk eroding trust?
Well, thanks for having me, and this is a great place to start. You know, AI is changing everything right now, not just medicine, not just GI, but all of human civilization, really. So these are big questions about how we're going to achieve what I like to think of as BI, or blended intelligence. How do we combine our wisdom as humans and as human doctors and human gastroenterologists with the incredible intelligence and knowledge base of AI systems? And what I like to say is I don't think AI is going to replace doctors, but I do think that doctors who learn how to use AI, especially humanistically, will replace the doctors who don't. And so that's something to think a lot about. What does it mean to work humanistically in partnership with AI systems? This is something we need to start thinking very hard about. And the ACG has been doing that. We need our medical students to start learning about what does it mean to work with an AI system and not let the AI just take over your ability to think critically and to, for example, do a physical exam. AI does not do a physical exam at this point. Humans do. AI does not look patients in the eye and conduct shared decision-making in the same way that a human doctor does. AI does not yet do a colonoscopy in the way a human does. So what does that mean? All of a sudden, we need to focus on the very things that probably drove us into medicine in the first place. Doing a careful history, looking people in the eyes, doing a proper physical exam, learning how to do procedures, because we're not going to know more than the AI will know, but we can do the things that humans do, the stuff that really drove us to be doctors in the first place, to be empathic, to be thoughtful, to be wise, not just to know a lot of stuff. And so the doctors that figure out how to leverage the ability of AI to maximize knowledge and information, but to combine it or blend it with their clinical intuition, with their ability to conduct a history, look people in the eyes, do physical exams, do really good endoscopies. That's what's going to make the best doctors even better.
Fascinating. And so a follow-up question is specifically as it relates to the physician-patient relationship and trust. Do you see, how do we use AI to better enhance the trust instead of, some of the concerns that patients are having? You know, you're relying on AI, or when we're using ambient AI, the physician is less involved in writing the notes. Like, what's your advice to physicians using AI today and trying to get the utopia of blended intelligence?
Yeah.
To improve the trust instead of the eroded.
Well, trust is really the biggest issue. And you're right to hold me to that part of your question because I didn't really directly address it. And, you know, when we think of trust, and I think this will probably come up later in our conversation too. We think that the patient needs to trust that we have their best, their well-being in mind. And we're working on their behalf, making the best decisions that we can make for them, and not ceding our ability to do that to a computer, but rather working with that computer. And that means we have to also trust that the computer has been vetted properly. If we're using a diagnostic algorithm, we need to make sure that it's accurate. And this is something we might come back to a little bit later. We need to make sure that it's not propagating bias, another topic we might want to talk about. Trust is involved in all of those things. How do we trust? How does a patient trust that the doctor is, first of all, using AI that can enhance or augment their ability to take care of patients, and that those doctors have taken the time, or the health systems have taken the time, to ensure that they are trustworthy, accurate, explainable programs and systems and algorithms? That's really at the core of probably what we'll talk about today, and at the core of where we are right now in understanding these AI systems, because these are not like regular algorithms. These are not like any other technology ever before. And that's because they think for themselves. They think. And that's crazy. Like, that's a crazy concept. So that means we need to trust that we can keep these things within guardrails, and we can make sure that they're safe. And trust is at the core of all of this. And I think we'll probably explore more of this as we go on.
So I want to make sure I'm understanding you correctly. You think that physicians should use AI that were vetted by other physicians, not just an AI software. It should be a medical AI, for example, if we're going to...
So it all depends on the use case. Right. So at our hospital at Cedar Sinai, and I'm sure yours and others have similar approaches, before we can bring an AI algorithm into our clinical practice, it needs to meet certain criteria, pretty strict criteria. You know, we'll have a third party try and hack into it, for example. We'll test it out extensively with different patient scenarios, even sometimes with digitally synthesized patients who are engaging with the user or with the agent, if it's a patient-facing agent, for example. If it's a diagnostic algorithm, we're going to test it out extensively. We want to understand the receiver-operator characteristic curve, accuracy. All of these things need to be meticulously evaluated step by step before we just start using it in clinical practice, just like we would expect of a medication. Right? We don't just take some herbal off the shelf and start giving it to people. We need to understand, what does it do? How does it work? What's its mechanism of action? The same applies here. And so, you know, if somebody wants to use GPT, for example, to help answer a question, I mean, that seems fine, but let's make sure you're not putting any, personal health information into that, because now all of a sudden you're giving OpenAI direct access to PHI. And so at Cedar Sinai, for example, we have our own instance of GPT called CS, Cedar Sinai GPT, which we have a business agreement with OpenAI and Microsoft that they cannot, curate or cultivate any of the data that we put into it. So even there, just using an off-the-shelf AI system, you need to be quite careful in how you're using it. And that's all goes back to that trust issue that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, I definitely think physicians need to be educated on that.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing this education. You mentioned bias.
Mm.
And, you know, that's a major ethical concern with AI and mm-hmm. the bias embedded. And we've all noticed it when you request an image generation, there's clearly a bias. You know, when I ask for a nurse, often it comes a female image. How can we ensure that AI tools used in GI don't perpetuate disparity in care, especially in underrepresented populations?
I mean, this is really one of the most important and frankly, you know, urgent issues in AI. So it's great that you brought this up. You know, bias doesn't just begin with the algorithm. It, in a way, it begins with us, because if we train AI on data sets that underrepresent certain groups, whether it's by race or gender or geography or socioeconomic status, then we risk baking existing disparities into our future care. So in GI, that could mean missing polyps in certain individuals, or inaccurate risk stratification, or, you know, treatment recommendations that don't apply across all populations, because we're just propagating these biases that were in the data that led to the model in the first place. So the question is always, how do we address it? I mean, this is a general question, not just GI, but in any biomedical AI use, is we need transparency. So ideally, AI developers should disclose the demographics of their training data, diversity. So tools should be validated across broad and representative populations before they're deployed. And we also need post-deployment monitoring, because bias can emerge in the wild, even if it wasn't obvious in development. And so as an example, we created an AI system here where we provide mental health support for patients in the hospital. And you can imagine that that could be biased. It might give different advice depending upon who it's talking to. So we've actually tested that. And before we deployed it, we measured its sentiment, the literal tone in its voice that it's using, depending on who it's talking to. And we found that actually, it did not reveal evidence of implicit bias, which was great. And we published that paper in our methods. And although, you know, who knows what it can do in the future, we got to watch it, we can at least feel confident for the moment that it doesn't seem to be perpetuating implicit bias in that example.
Well, that's amazing that, you know, not only you said you tested it, we also need to monitor it. So as the algorithm evolve, mm-hmm. we have to test them. I don't know if AI will be monitoring AI.
Right. Well, it's a good question, because we do have AI monitoring AI. So in that example I just gave, where we provide mental health support, you think, well, what could possibly go wrong? You know, well, who knows, right? What if the AI says something stupid? Like, we try to make sure the AI is following best practices in, let's say, cognitive behavioral therapy. But what if it says something terrible or gives inappropriate advice? Worse, you know, discusses suicidality without, you know, in the wrong way, for example. So we actually have a second AI that is monitoring the first AI. In case the first AI goes off the rails, the second AI is programmed to stop whatever the first AI is saying, and it required to go back and restate. Now, it turns out, to my knowledge, it hasn't been triggered yet, except in experimental settings, but it's there if and when we need it, because we are actually using this in real time in our hospital.
So, Brandon, the next, you know, the question that flows from this is accountability in the terms of AI, as well as kind of how it fits in the medical legal environment. So, for example, AI recommends the wrong treatment to a patient when the patient is talking to a bot and not a physician. Or if you miss a polyp when using AI-augmented visualization during colonoscopy, or if a radiologist misses a lung lesion that wasn't picked up by the AI algorithm. Who is going to be responsible ethically, legally? Is it the AI developer? Is it the physician user? Is it the institution that deployed the algorithm, which could be, you know, accused of not adequately vetting it before it was put into practice?
Yeah, this is a great question. It's definitely a thorny question, because there's a lot of different people involved. As you mentioned, there's developers and there's the physicians, there's the institutions and the health systems themselves. And really, it sits to me at the intersection of ethics and law and ultimately clinical responsibility. And, you know, this is an evolving discussion. I don't know that there's a universally accepted framework for how to approach this question, because the use cases vary and everyone has some responsibility. Now, ultimately, as I think about it, the physician has the final say. So if a physician has decided that they are relying upon an algorithm, they still need to use their clinical judgment, their best clinical judgment, to make a decision. Just like if we have an EKG, you know, not that I can read one anymore, but right, you get an EKG. And by the way, at the top of the EKG, there's a little AI thing that says what the reading is, right? But every cardiologist knows, well, I'll read that and I'll take that under advisement, but I'm still a cardiologist. So I need to, you know, read the EKG and make my decision. For gastroenterologists, if we're using an AI polyp detection system, okay, well, it's augmenting your ability to find polyps. You should not rely entirely on that, you know, algorithm to draw a box around every polyp. What happens, by the way, if like that software is not working one day? You know, we have to be able to find polyps on our own. This is a big issue for our trainees, by the way, because it's your responsibility. So yeah, I mean, the developers, of course, we need to rely on them to create safe and validated and transparent tools. And then we need to ensure that our health systems are properly vetting them. And just like any other technology, any other clinical decision support or CDS tool that we might use, we need to make sure it's gone through vetting, it's evidence-based. But in the end of the day, it's sort of our responsibility as human doctors to do the right thing. Now, that said, you can see all these in situations where it might get complicated. You know, something misdiagnoses something completely. It's just absolutely wrong. Definitively wrong, and we get thrown off by it because we have to rely also on the technology around us doing what it's supposed to do. But it's a tricky one. I just don't know that it's anything unique because we've always relied on technologies, whether it's imaging technologies, endoscopic technologies, you know, you name it. And the lab tests that we run, you know, sometimes, you know, a lab test seems off. You have to ask yourself, like, should I just take this blindly or do I maybe retest it? Because it doesn't make sense, the result that I just got. Maybe the lab's wrong. You know, you got to use your judgment. So anyway, that's my thought about it. I don't know if that's super helpful or not, but ultimately it still comes down to us as doctors.
Yeah, it is. I think your answer is very helpful, especially in terms of we've always relied on technology. One thing that we've taken for granted, and I have two follow-up questions from your answer, is, you know, we've taken for granted that we use technology versus a lot of times with AI, we're asked to obtain informed consent. Mm-hmm. For example, when we use the ambient AI, you're required to tell the patient, I'm going to use ambient AI to help me with my note writing. So should that be the case? Or since we've already relied on technology, that's another tool for technology. And what happens if the patient says, I don't want you to use AI?
Yeah.
Since we're giving them that, you know, informed consent and that option.
Yeah, that's a great question. The informed consent question is a tricky one. I've heard different points of view about this in the era of AI. So the easy answer would be, oh yeah, well, anytime you're using AI, you must tell the patient that you're using AI. But I don't really think that that's practical. So that's the first part of the question. The second part will be, what if they say, I don't want to use AI? Then that's, but just kind of the first part, like, you know, we don't typically get consent every time there's any kind of possible AI system at use. Like that EKG example I just gave you. We don't say to the patient, listen, we're gonna do an EKG on you. I need to get consent because it turns out there is a computer system that's gonna look at your EKG and it's going to make a diagnosis. Is that okay? We don't have time to talk about that. Like, we've been doing that since the 1970s. And that is a form of computer learning. It is a form of AI. May not be all that great, but we have all sorts of AI systems all the time. So the line then starts to blur, though, if AI is moving from kind of passive support, like, you know, a little bit of light clinical decision support, to active decision making. You know, if a tool is generating a differential diagnosis, if it's drafting your clinical note in its entirety, you know, with ambient AI, for example, this does raise some new questions, especially if patients might assume that everything came directly from the doctor when it might not have all come directly from the doctor. So to me, it kind of depends on how much thinking the AI is doing. The more autonomous the system, the more important it is to be transparent. But again, at the end of the day, it's the physician who has the responsibility. Now, if you're going to use an ambient AI scribe, I mean, you got to tell the patient you're doing that. That's an example. And if the patient says, I don't want you to do that, then okay, we're not going to do it. We got to go back to the way we've always done medicine, which is just, you know, unfortunately, in many cases, it's people turning their back to the patient and typing on a computer screen. So, you know, we would have to explain to the patient, like, well, this is why I use it. It's the transparency part. This is how it helps me. This is how I can pay closer attention to what you're saying and probably make it even more accurate, because I won't forget things that you said. And you can look at the note too. And I'm going to look at the note, and there's a human in the loop. So that means I'm going to still have a chance to edit this note to make sure it's accurate. Now, if you say all of that and the patient still is not interested, then that's the way it goes. So I don't know. It's a complicated question.
It is. And thank you for the answer. You know, you also mentioned, you know, clinical judgment versus algorithmic output, and how do people use it? There's today no training on, if the AI says A and you think it's B, how do you integrate this information? You talked about blended intelligence. Mm-hmm. Like, what kind of training do physicians need to acquire these skills? And is it fair to just throw in an AI algorithm and say, hey, this is helping you? Or do we need training on the algorithms?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we do need to train. And I mentioned how medical schools now especially need to train. And then the question is, experienced clinicians who have been out there for years and years and now have these new technologies at their fingertips, how much do they pivot their approach to patients in light of this new set of technologies? It's a really important mindset shift that we have to get right. So as I've said before, you know, I don't think AI will replace doctors. AI is meant to be an assistant, you know, a really skilled intern, not your replacement. So it's there to augment your thinking, you know, not to override your thinking. So I always think that the key is to treat AI like you would any other consultant, you know, listen to its opinion, you know, understand where it's coming from, but then you make your own call. And, you know, how we train people to do that is still evolving. You know, I'll also say, like, clinical judgment is also a lot more than mere pattern recognition. That's a big part of it. We're good at seeing patterns, and so is AI. But it's also about empathy. It's about nuance. It's about understanding patient preference. It's about biopsychosocial care. AI doesn't really do that stuff. Humans do that stuff. So we have to know, like, where is the AI really good? Kind of goes to what I said before. You know, it's good at knowing stuff. It's good at writing down a history that it's been recorded ambiently. You know, it's good at a lot of stuff that's also kind of bureaucratic, like filling out, you know, insurance forms. But it's not great at looking people in the eye, and it's not great at, you know, like, we don't want to outsource those human skills to the computer. So I guess it's hard for me to say what the best approach is, but I would just say, you know, our clinician colleagues need to stay curious. Why is the AI recommending what it's doing? Why is it matching your instincts or not? If it's not, then, you know, you need to dig in. And the best clinicians are going to learn to see AI not as a crutch, but as a second opinion that forces them to sharpen their own thinking.
No, it's very true. Now, shifting gears a little bit, let's talk about data ownership. And I think that's something we've been alluding to throughout the conversation. And certainly, you know, as physicians who are considering integrating AI into their practices, whether or not it's a physician-owned practice or a hospital, one thing that always comes up is who owns the data? Because as we're learning in the 21st century, the data is very valuable. And without large quantities of data, these companies cannot develop algorithms that they can also then sell back to us. So how do you tackle those issues, both as a practicing physician integrating AI into your practice and also as a physician leader in a health system?
Yeah, well, I think it's a good starting point to say that patients own their own data, full stop. So it's their body, you know, it's their story, it's their information. But in practice, this can get complicated because, you know, while patients own the data, health systems will store the data. Companies might use the data to build tools. So the real issue isn't necessarily just the ownership part, but it's consent and it's access and it's control. And this is really where things get thorny and complicated. I do think patients should have a say in how their data are used. That makes sense. It came from them, especially when it's fueling a commercial AI model. They should consent to that. They should know that their data are being used to fuel a commercial AI model. I think we need guardrails around that and transparency around that. Of course, if we're going to do that, we have to be very careful about de-identification and data sharing, because it's not just a technical resource, it's a reflection of people's lives that we're dealing with. So anyway, patients own their data, but we have a responsibility to treat the data with respect, protect it, ensure it's being used to actually improve care, not just to optimize profits. But this is a complicated morass, really. So that's the best I can say, I think, on this really tricky topic.
Yeah. Honestly, you're just teaching us how evolving this field is and how there are many areas where we need answers and we need a lot of reflection on how to handle them.
Yeah.
One area of particular interest to me, especially working with cancer patients, is a lot of predictive AI models are coming up that kind of adjust your risk from average risk to some other risk for specific cancers, especially in the world of genomics, where genetic material is analyzed by AI and an output comes. We have a lot of protection against pre-existing conditions for healthcare, not so much outside of immediate healthcare. So what are the ethical boundaries and how could these analytics be used carefully so not to disadvantage certain patients, for example, and getting a denial for life insurance? Because in the chart we put based on this algorithm, you are at increased risk for lung cancer, for example. And if a life insurance get that record, they might deny. Any thoughts on, is anyone debating this issue? And where do you think the boundaries, especially a lot of these AIs will change with time and their accuracy change? Would love to hear your reflections on that.
Yeah. Well, this is also an amazing question. And boy, we can talk for days about this one. And I'm not the world's expert either, but I think there are certain principles that we should think about. So as you pointed out, predictive models can be very powerful. But with that power comes real ethical risk. So on the one hand, if we know who's at higher risk for colon cancer, let's say, or who's at higher risk for readmission, after discharge for hepatic encephalopathy or IBD or whatever, we can intervene earlier. We can personalize care better and we can save lives. I mean, that's the upside. That's the power of having such strong predictive abilities, but the same data could be used to exclude rather than include, right? If a predictive score gets into the hands of a life insurer or an employer or even a hospital trying to optimize its margins, we could start to see decisions that work against patients. There could be perverse incentives to not do the right thing, but to do the financially right thing, which may or may not align with the patient's best interests. Might deny coverage, limit access, reinforce structural inequities. So yeah, you're right. I mean, we need firm boundaries here. And this is where we need legal and ethical experts. Predictive analytics should serve the patient, not the system. I mean, I think that's a good starting point. That means clear regulations and ethical oversight and transparency about how these risk scores are being used. Because we can predict something doesn't mean that we should act on it, let's say, without a clear benefit to the individual. So again, I don't want to get too much deeper into this because I'm not an ethicist or a legal expert. And I don't know exactly where the boundary should be drawn or the legal frameworks around that. But the simple starting point is beneficence. It's doing the right thing for the patient at the right time and not falling prey to perverse incentives that end up leading to denials, lack of coverage, or hospitals protecting their margins. I think that'd be an absolutely horrible use of AI, but it's a real dystopian possibility.
Yeah, we saw some of that, in the fires in California.
Yes.
Where insurances dropped areas that are at risk for fire. So we're seeing it even outside of healthcare. Yeah, and I'm wondering what the GI societies and the physician society's role, in your opinion, is to alert to that and help regulators.
Well, you know, societies are great at position statements, at getting, you know, we're good at that. But I think, you know, the ACG has been very good at putting groups together around this, but I don't know if we've had a really good mixed group of ethicists, you know, bioethicists, legal experts, and clinicians who have gotten together, at least in GI, and I could be wrong, to lay out in more detail than I can here, what is that framework look like, you know, right? So that we appropriately use predictive algorithms for cancer, for other diseases. I think it's such a vital question. It's just one that, you know, I need to think a lot harder about.
So turning to questions all of us should be thinking harder about, and I think, you know, without a clear answer, but as we wrap up, what do you see as the future of artificial intelligence in gastroenterology? And what do you think, you know, should be the bodies, the organizations that are creating the guardrails for what AI should and should not be doing and how it should or should not be used in GI?
Yeah, well, some of this may be a little bit of a repeat, but I'll try to kind of bring together the strands that we've been talking about, because it goes back to what I said at the top of our interview. I see a future where AI does not replace gastroenterologists. It amplifies our work. And AI won't replace GIs, but GIs who use AI might replace those who don't. So part of that is really making sure we train and get up to speed as quickly as possible, but as safely as possible. There's this future in front of us where, you know, we can have tools that catch polyps that we might miss, or predict IBD flares before they happen, or personalized treatment based on data that we could never have synthesized alone, or patterns we never could have seen with our own human eyes and brain. This is not science fiction. I mean, this is happening right now, but we can't get there safely without building the right guardrails now. And that's been a theme of a lot of our discussion today, is having ethical standards around bias and explainability and transparency and accountability and clarity on liability. And so this is where GI societies like the ACG absolutely need to be involved. Now, ACG has started to do some of this, but I think we can really redouble our efforts, figure out on a society level, what do we expect for our patients, and how do we put that into words? How do we improve fellowship training programs, or not improve, but update or modernize fellowship training programs so that we're all, you know, preaching from the same psalm book, I guess. Like, we're all talking about the same framework with the same ethical standards. Have to have some consistency in how we're approaching this, and that will allow us to have this future of beneficence. Because as we sit here today, we're talking about GI, but as we sit here today, we're on the elbow of an exponential curve. And what we're seeing is an absolute explosion in technology beyond the likes of anyone's expectations. And so there are two possible futures in front of us. There's one of human beneficence and longevity and abundance, where we take care of the patients that we, you know, in our communities, and everyone's doing great. And then there's another dystopian future, right? Where we have predictive algorithms that are being misused, where we have a loss of our own ability to think. Our human consciousness is being replaced in mineral computer systems, right? You know, we got the Terminators coming at us. Like, that's the other side of all of this. So we have to think about, how do we stay out of that second part and move towards the first part? And that's where societies like ACG and conversations like this can at least raise awareness about what the issues are, and then work in an interdisciplinary way with the right experts at the table to flesh out, to framework, what does that future look like, to keep us on the rails and not moving into that dystopian Terminator future.
This is fascinating. Thank you, Dr. Spiegel, for sharing your expertise, your thoughts, and letting us know that with all the excitement about AI, we have to do it right. We can't just adopt anything blindly. We have to be really discriminative, and we have to design the future, not just, you know, be passive in using these algorithms.
Exactly. Yes. Well, You couldn't have said it better. Or I couldn't have said it better. You said it.
Thank you for listening to Brains and Guts, the GI Innovation Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, please subscribe and drop us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also send us questions and ideas for future episodes to brainsandguts@gi.org. We look forward to talking to you soon.